Psalm 62, then, is our text this evening as we continue in our Sunday evening studies of the Psalms. And you can see just from a glance at this psalm that it involves a fair bit of word repetition. Rock, fortress, refuge, trust, and so on. Words are continually reused throughout these 12 verses. And there's one Hebrew word which doesn't occur as frequently as some words do here, but it does occur twice. And this particular repetition goes under the radar, or at least it goes under the radar if you're reading the ESV, because the ESV translates the Hebrew word using a different English word in each of the two occurrences. So in verse 4, it translates it falsehood, whereas in verse 9, it translates it delusion. If I were producing a Bible translation, I would probably go in both places for deception. That's what this Hebrew word means, deception. And this is an interesting repetition then. All those other repeated words that I mentioned just now, rock, fortress, refuge, trust, they're all nice words, aren't they? They're all the kind of words that you might expect to see on a Christian calendar printed across a lovely picture of mountains and rivers and forests and all that kind of stuff. Deception? Well, that's different. That's jarring. You don't want a word like that on your Christian calendar. But the psalmist here uses it not once but twice. It's something that's on his mind. It's something that's troubling him as he writes this piece. He's keenly aware of people in his life who are not what they seem. There's some kind of deception going on with them. Actually, he's not talking about exactly the same kind of thing in verses 4 and 9. That's probably why the ESV opts for two different words. The people who are concerning him here, the people who aren't what they seem, the people who are prompting these reflections of his on the theme of deception, they fall into two quite distinct categories. And so that's how we're going to approach this psalm this evening. And so notice, first of all, then, he has on his mind malicious people whose company is deceptively pleasant. Malicious people whose company is deceptively pleasant. This is what he's talking about in verses 3 and 4. He writes in a rather indirect manner here, but when in the first half of verse 3 he speaks of a man and him, and in the first part of verse 4 of him and his, he's probably referring to himself. He's describing treatment here which he himself has experienced. What kind of treatment is it? Well, in a word, hatred. That's what's going on in verses 3 and 4. The psalmist has been subjected to hatred. He describes here a bunch of people who want to disgrace him, pulling him down, he says, from his high position. They want to reduce him, he says, to the human equivalent of a leaning wall or a tottering fence. They want the very, very worst for him. That's what that word curse there at the end of verse 4 means in biblical terms. Not letting out an indelicate word when you stub your toe or something. Cursing isn't that. Cursing is wishing on someone consummate, unmitigated misfortune and disaster. Go to hell, people today might exclaim angrily sometimes. But in fact, they don't actually believe in hell. Well, imagine believing in hell and then saying to someone, in all earnestness, go to hell. I hope that you suffer misery and torment for all eternity. That's cursing. I'm saying the people described then in verses 3 and 4, they hate the psalmist. But this is the thing. You would never know that from the way they are when they're with him. When they're with him, their speech and manner don't betray any cursing. It's kept an inward thing, verse 4 says, while outwardly, with their mouths, the psalmist says, they bless. They speak lovely, favorable words to the psalmist. And this two-facedness then, it's not them complying with social convention and being outwardly nice to this man they hate because being outwardly nice is the done thing. No, they actually enjoy the performance aspect of the whole thing. It tickles them. The fact that they're pretending to be so pleasant to a man whose complete and utter ruin they are hoping to bring about. They derive a perverse pleasure, verse 4 says, from their deception. And so you see what I mean then by my heading, malicious people whose company is deceptively pleasant. That's what the psalmist has in view, I'm saying, in verses 3 and 4. And perhaps it's something that you know something about. Maybe not quite to the same degree, maybe not this level of hatred dressed up in this level of pleasantness, but perhaps you at least recognize the basic phenomenon here that the psalmist is talking about. You've been the recipient of a friendliness to your face, but a friendliness to your face which you suspect bears no resemblance to how the person or persons actually think of you, or perhaps indeed no resemblance to how the person or persons are actually behaving in relation to you behind the scenes. And if you do have some experience of that, then you'll know it's a truly horrible and hurtful business. It's grim, of course, to have people mistreating you at all. But to have people mistreating you who present themselves as your allies, who cloak their mistreatment in this deceptive pleasantness, that leaves a particularly bad taste, doesn't it? There's something so shameless and cynical and treacherous about it. And what effect does it have on you when you're the recipient of this sort of thing? Well, it affects you in lots of ways, but one effect it can easily have is this. It makes you doubt everyone. Anyone who appears to be for you, whose outward stance toward you is one of blessing, you smell a rat. You're skeptical. You've been hoodwinked before, and you're not going to be hoodwinked again. You're disinclined to take the blessing at face value, because behind it, the person is probably cursing you, really. That's the effect that it can have on you. Mistrust becomes your default position. And it's an understandable effect. It's a self-preservation instinct kicking in, I suppose. By mistrusting everyone now, you're not going to get hurt again. And self-preservation instincts are not entirely unhealthy, are they? They are part of our wiring as human beings. But we do need to be careful about mistrust. However hurt we may have been by deceptively pleasant people, mistrust mustn't become too deeply ingrained within us. If we start to disbelieve everyone who blesses us, that is a huge, huge problem. Why? Well, one of Psalm 62's close neighbours is Psalm 67. And Psalm 67 refers three times to God blessing us. It begins, "May God be gracious to us and bless us and make his face to shine upon us." I think that's as good a description as you'll ever get of what it is to belong to God's people. It's to be the objects of his grace, his blessing, and his shining face. And the danger then, if we start to doubt and disbelieve everyone who blesses us, is that that will include even God himself. I was talking the other week to the guys who were decorating this building, and the conversation turned at one point to that subject that we all love to talk about, COVID. And I was quite taken aback by their perspective on COVID. As far as they were concerned, the whole thing was planned by the government. It wasn't a naturally occurring phenomenon. It wasn't even the work of the Chinese. It was Boris and Rishi and Matt Hancock and co. They were somehow going to benefit from the pandemic, and so it was all a big scheme concocted in Whitehall. And it was the matter-of-fact way in which the decorators expressed this that startled me. There was no sense of this being controversial or speculative. One of them stated it, and the other two responded, "Oh, aye, yeah, definitely, you're right there." As though it were just, you know, the most basic and obvious and self-evident proposition that anyone had ever heard. And I guess then, mistrust is a very powerful lens, isn't it? And once it's in place, then you can look at the government in 2020 with its lockdowns and its furlough schemes and its Nightingale hospitals and all the rest of it, and you can see just a bunch of crooks manufacturing a pandemic entirely for their own ends. And I'm saying that powerful lens of mistrust can come to distort our view of God. We've been hurt by people who are friendly in their outward manner, while in reality nasty and unkind toward us. And so we're disillusioned, and that lens that I'm talking about begins to form, that lens of mistrust. Our entire outlook becomes wary and suspicious until we reach a point where we can look at God blessing us in Christ, and we can see an insincere deity who behind that gracious exterior doesn't actually care tuppence about us. That's the danger. That's the danger. Now, you might be thinking, well, Dan, all this stuff about the effect that two-faced people can have on us and the way it can engender this mistrust that spills over into our view of God, that's very interesting, but aren't we straying somewhat from Psalm 62? You might be thinking that. Well, no, we're not straying from Psalm 62, because there's something here very striking, and it's this. The psalmist doesn't let it happen to him. Look at how the psalm ends. Verse 11 goes, "Once God has spoken, twice have I heard this." That's just a way of kind of being emphatic about what he's about to say. That power belongs to God. And at that point, you're thinking as a reader, uh-oh, perhaps his experience at the hands of those guys in verses 3 and 4 has affected his view of God. Perhaps he's suggesting here now, at the end of the psalm, that behind all the kind words, God is really just a big, powerful bully who likes to batter people till they're leaning walls or tottering fences. Verse 11 could be going, it seems, down that route. But then comes the beautiful verse 12. "And that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love." It's that Hebrew word hesed, which also cropped up in the previous psalm, Psalm 61. Hesed is love that you can trust. Love that you can stake everything on. Reliable love. And as readers then, we suddenly breathe a sigh of relief. The psalmist isn't doubting God's integrity. He isn't putting God in the same category as those deceptively pleasant people that he's had dealings with recently. No, he's contrasting God with them. He's saying others are unreliable. Others appear to be one thing, while in fact they're something else altogether. But you, O God, aren't like that. To you, O Lord, belongs reliable love. Your love actually is what it says it is. A truly loving heart, a truly loving disposition lies behind your loving words. By the way, the next sentence with which the psalm really does end is making a similar point. "For you will render to a man according to his work." That sentence doesn't have a menacing tone. Derek Kidner explains things well. He says the glance at retribution here is a grateful one. Not so much preoccupied with final judgment, if that is in the picture at all, as with God's fair dealing in general, which has none of the duplicity which the psalm has deplored. And so I'm saying the psalmist finishes this song then, demonstrating a delightfully healthy attitude. Wounded by duplicitous people whose company is deceptively pleasant, he hasn't started to suspect a duplicitous God. And we must make sure that our view of God isn't affected when we are on the receiving end of two-faced behavior from other people. Believer, there may be times in your life when you are deeply let down and have to conclude that people you considered friends were in fact enemies all along. But at those times, do not, whatever you do, tar God with the same brush. Don't allow your thoughts about him to be influenced by your experiences of them. You really are the object of God's grace, God's blessing, and God's shining face. Believe that, Christian. Don't be cautious and reserved about all of that, out of fear that God may actually be deceiving you. No, repeat often, to you, O Lord, belongs reliable love. To you, O Lord, belongs reliable love. To you, O Lord, belongs reliable love. Indeed, at those times when human beings prove deceptive, far from starting to doubt God's love, find your comfort therein at those times. Allow the unreliability of others' love to make the reliability of God's love even more precious in your sight. And so, it's vitally important that we don't let the deceptive pleasantness that sometimes we shall experience from people color our view of God's gracious blessings and God's gracious promises, and think that because people have proven inauthentic, maybe God is inauthentic. No, no, believer. God can be taken at his word. So we've seen then the psalmist has on his mind here malicious people whose company is deceptively pleasant. But notice with me secondly that he also has on his mind mesmerizing people whose circumstances are deceptively prosperous. Mesmerizing people whose circumstances are deceptively prosperous. This is what he's talking about in verse 9. So notice that he begins there, those of low estate are but a breath. Now those of low estate are simply ordinary people, just regular members of society. The word breath there is that word that occurs so often in Ecclesiastes, which our English versions rather unfortunately translate vanity. Vapor is its true meaning. And the point then in both Ecclesiastes and here is impermanence. That's what that word vapor is really getting at. Vapor doesn't hang around long, does it? It isn't fixed and durable. It lingers for a short while and then vanishes. And that first line of verse 9 is saying then, that's the life of Joe Bloggs. That's the life of the ordinary man or woman on the streets. It's impermanent. Like vapor, it lingers for a short while and then vanishes. So that's the first line of verse 9. And then the second line moves on to those of high estate. Those of high estate are the very wealthy. Now, he could just say exactly the same thing about them. They are vapor here for just a moment. He believes that. That's clear in the second half of the verse, where he continues, in the balances, they go up. They are together lighter than a breath. He's picturing there a weighing scales, a pre-digital weighing scales, you'll understand. Where you have those two receptacles, one on either side of the thing, and you put things then in both the receptacles, and of course the heavier side will go down, and the lighter side will go up. And the psalmist says then you put human beings of both estates, the low and the high, you put them in one side of the scales, and they go up. He doesn't even bother to tell us what's put in the other side of the scales, it's irrelevant. Because all human beings, whether low or high, are vapor. That's his point. They are together, he says at the end of the verse. That's low and high. Together, they are lighter than a breath. So as I say, he believes the wealthy to be vapor too. And he could just say that in the second line of the verse, but he doesn't. He changes the word from vapor to this word that I'm saying means deception. What's his point? Well, his point is that while in reality the wealthy are just as vaporous and impermanent as everyone else, they don't appear to be. That's the point. They don't appear to be. All that money in the bank, all those properties in different places, all those snazzy cars being driven along, all those expensive facelifts, they give a false impression of solidity and fixedness and invulnerability. These people don't look like vapor, not in the least. Their circumstances, as I put it in the heading, are deceptively prosperous. Everyone looks at the multimillionaire and sees only the glittering trappings of wealth. The reality, however, behind it all is a heart that is wearing out, a brain whose neurons are dying, a body that's heading inexorably for the grave, an allotted lifespan of 80 or 90 or 100 years that's on an unrelenting countdown. That's the reality. Vanishing vapor, not prosperity. The prosperity is deceptive. But I used the word mesmerizing in my heading. Mesmerizing people whose circumstances are deceptively prosperous. And they are, aren't they? You see these men and women leading such affluent lifestyles. And it's hard not to be taken in by the whole thing. It's hard not to deem their situations ever so desirable. How do we stop ourselves being taken in? Well, according to the psalmist, we do two things. There's something negative that we do and there's something positive that we do. Negatively, then, we fight the allurement. We fight the allurement. Look at the last line of verse 10. If riches increase, set not your heart on them. Now, he doesn't say there, if your riches increase, set not your heart on them. In which case, he would only really be talking here to rich people and saying that they mustn't set their heart on their riches. But I don't think that's what he means. What he means is something more like this. If it's in the nature of riches to increase, and of course it is, then dot, dot, dot. Yeah, it was Percy Shelley, was it not, who first came up with the aphorism, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. There are all sorts of avenues, aren't there, open to you to make money if you already have money. If you have riches, then those riches are likely to increase. That's the point that Shelley was making, and that's the point, I think, that the last line of verse 10 is making. And the psalmist's point, then, is that as you see that principle at work in the lives of others, as you see these rich people who, because they have riches, are able to get richer and richer and richer, while you perhaps can't even get your foot on the bottom rung of the economic ladder, he's saying, don't let that sight captivate you. Don't set your heart on what you're seeing there. That's what he's saying. I ask you the question then, are you careful what you set your heart on? What do we mean by that language? It's interesting that the next psalm, Psalm 63, that God willing will come to, it has that concept there in verse 6, doesn't it, of what you remember when you're in bed at night, what you meditate on when you can't get to sleep in the watches of the night. What do you think about when you're lying there in bed in the middle of the night, unable to sleep? Perhaps you do fantasize about the prosperous lifestyles that you've seen other people live in. And that's what the psalmist is saying in verse 10 of our psalm, that we mustn't do. Don't set your heart on that kind of thing. Don't fantasize about that. Fight the allurement. It's interesting, isn't it, that there in the verse, it's set in such close proximity to the references to extortion and robbery. Perhaps a reminder then that when we do start to set our hearts on a prosperous lifestyle that we've seen other people live in, that can lead us actually to some very desperate measures. It's what Paul writes to Timothy, isn't it? The love of money is a root of all kinds of evils, 1 Timothy 6:10. And so how do we stop ourselves being taken in? Well, we just have to fight the allurement. And fight what we're setting our hearts on. Fight what we're fantasizing about. Fight where our thought lives are going. That's the negative side of how we stop ourselves being taken in by these mesmerizing, prosperous, affluent lives that we see being lived by people. But if that's the negative side, then positively, we focus on something else. Negatively, we don't focus on that, but positively, we focus on something else. Now, I talked at the start about repeated words here in Psalm 62, and one of those repeated words you'll immediately notice is salvation. Salvation. Four times that's used in verse 1, verse 2, verse 6, and verse 7. And in each case, it's used with the first person possessive pronoun my salvation. And in each case, then, there's an emphasis on the source of salvation, namely God. That's been emphasized in each of those four references. You also get quite an emphasis, don't you, on its futureness, that this is something being waited for. That's the language in verse 1 and verse 5. This salvation is being waited for. But there's only one instance of these four where the content of the salvation is suggested to us. And that's verse 7, where he says, on God rests my salvation and my glory. And I think glory there is intended as a synonym, a word meaning the same thing as the other one he's just used, namely salvation. And so I think he's saying there in verse 7 that this salvation from God that he's talked about quite a bit already, this salvation from God that is to be waited for because it's in the future, it consists of glory, or it consists in glory. Now, that's an interesting word, the word glory. As some of you will know, the standard Hebrew word for glory, it has to do with weightiness and substance. And you see the significance of that here then in Psalm 62. Here the psalmist says these prosperous lifestyles, and they have an apparent glory about them which mesmerizes us. It all looks so great, so fantastic, so splendid, but it's fake. That glory is fake. It's all just vapor. It's lightweight, it's featherweight, it flies up. It's all part of the vapor of human mortality. It goes, it vanishes. But you see, the psalmist here awaits from God a glory that is really glory, that actually has weight, that actually has substance, that actually has gravity to it. There's nothing vaporous about the glory that he's waiting for. There's the glory of the rich that he sees around him. It's vaporous. It's deceptively prosperous. But the glory that he's waiting for, It's real, it's weighty, it's substantial. And if you're a Christian this evening, then that's the glory you're waiting for. A glory that is really glory, a glory that is substantial. A glory which we know then from other parts of the Bible will flood our very body, so that as we saw the other Sunday morning, we shall shine like stars, Daniel 12 says, when that glory comes flooding in. A glory that will stretch or be stretched over every blade of grass and every bird and insect of that world that we shall then inhabit. A glory that above all else will characterize the central attraction of that world that we will then inhabit. The Lord Jesus Christ, the one who prayed and doubtless is still praying tonight. Father, I want those you have given me to be where I am, to see my glory, John 17:24. Glory everywhere, I'm saying. Glory everywhere. And when then you and I find ourselves being mesmerized by the deceptively prosperous circumstances of people around us, we need to focus on this glory that I'm talking about. We need to focus on that glory that awaits us. And we should scorn then the pathetic featherweight glory of those around us. We can sing, can't we, with John Newton, fading is the worldling's pleasure, all his boasted pomp and show, solid joys and lasting treasure, none but Zion's children know. And we can speak to ourselves then, those times when we're feeling drawn, we're feeling pulled by the deceptive prosperity of those around us, we can speak to ourselves those words of verse 5. For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence. My hope is from him. Just keep on waiting, soul. Your glory is yet to come, and your glory is infinitely better. Interesting, that concept of waiting in silence. It's the silence of confident expectation. You're a child, and next week the hopping starts, and you go along to the hoppings then, and you go with friends who have never been before, but you've been before. And as soon as you enter then, there's some piddly little ride there near the entrance, and all your friends are shouting about it. Mum, Dad, can I have some money? I want to go on that ride there, please. But you're not doing that. You're silent. Why? Because you know that there are way better rides ahead. It's the silence of confident expectation. And that's what the psalmist is talking about here. That's us as Christians, as others around us clamor after riches and possessions here and now. We can silently wait, knowing that there's way better riches and possessions ahead. There's glory. There's glory ahead. And we're not talking here about an unrealistic absolute silence, as though we never find it hard waiting. Because we have verse 8 as well, that reference to pouring out your heart before him. And sometimes there's a place for that, because we're struggling to wait. And we see everyone prospering around us, and it's hard just waiting and waiting for our glory. And so there are times when we just need to pour out our hearts to our Heavenly Father. But the main point, believer, is don't be mesmerized by deceptive prosperity. Wait for true prosperity. Wait for eternal glory, the eternal glory that God has promised you in Jesus Christ. As others noisily chase after vaporous treasure in the here and now, be confidently silent. On God rest your salvation and your glory. Be like those Hebrew believers. Remember how the writer to the Hebrews addresses them at the end of chapter 10, it's verse 34, and he recalls the early days when those Christians had been converted. And he says this, he says, at that time you sympathize with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property. Wow. You joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because, he continues, you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. And that should be our attitude as we look around and find sometimes the lifestyles of others so mesmerizing. We have better and lasting possessions. We have glory, salvation glory awaiting us. Let's confidently wait in silence for that day. May God bless his word. Amen.